From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest on the Oakland County water main break that has a 250,000 people boiling their water.
For folks getting their water back, they can use it for showering, washing clothes and things, but they really shouldn't consume it for until we've had our testing done.
Dangerous winds and waves batter the UP.
What we saw was a 28.8-foot wave north of Marquette, and that's the highest wave that's ever been recorded with modern records.
Writer Doug Stanton talks about his new book on the Vietnam War, which he calls one of America's unfinished narratives.
I can't tell you the depth of feeling that a generation of Americans has that no one has ever listened to them, whatever race or creed. It's shocking.
And the superstar magician who made West Michigan his summer home. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This hour...
When you ask a Vietnam veteran what happened, often they don't know how to begin to talk about it. And if you can't tell your story, it's not your story.
Michigan author Doug Stanton brings us the story of an Army recon platoon fighting its way through the Tet Offensive of 1968. But first, 12 communities in Oakland County are still under a boil water alert as repairs continue on a water main break being called unprecedented. With us now, Oakland County Water Resources Commissioner Jim Nash. Jim, where do things stand today?
Well, last I heard that they've ordered the pipe and they're waiting to come in. They're expecting to have it in by tonight, but that was their original timeline, so I haven't heard anything since then. But if it is in tonight, they're expecting to be able to do the testing by Friday and hopefully have this boil water lifted by Friday evening.
Because we're looking at, how many people in Oakland County at this point are boiling water or have no water?
Well, as of last night, it was 51,000. I think it's shrunk to less than that now, though, you know, for folks getting their water back, they can use it for showering, washing clothes and things, but they really shouldn't consume it for until we've had our testing done.
And then how many are boiling water?
You know, I couldn't tell you an exact number right now. It was over 300,000 at the beginning of this, but I'm not sure exactly. I know that some of them have come back on, although I'm not sure about the testing. In the communities we serve, we wait until the pressure is fully resolved before we start the testing because it could relapse and we don't want to have to test twice.
Now, when you're talking some 250,000 people, that is a pretty sizable event. And this was a 48-inch water line that failed that was installed in 1970. And I know the Great Lakes Water Authority says it's in the middle of its service life. Is this a canary in a coal mine in your view or a one-off that you hope won't happen again?
Well, it points out how much of an effect a small system failure can have. And we can have a huge number of people affected by something like this. So it's something that we always have to make sure we understand. Operation maintenance is how we judge how systems can last. And the better operations and maintenance you do, the longer a system will last. Like you said, 47-year-old system and a pipe this large is not very old at all, really. So we haven't seen anything as to the exact cause of what happened yet. That's something they'll decide once they've finished doing what they need to do to get service back.
Big picture question then. How are you feel about the condition of Oakland County's water infrastructure? When you're thinking about it, lying there at night thinking about it, how concerned are you?
Well, you know, this is always a concerning thing. Generally speaking, the communities themselves deal with the water, the drinking water side. We do more with the sewage and the stormwater issues for my office. So we operate and maintain a bunch of the communities that are affected, Farmington Hills, Commerce, a few of the others. But our operations are contingent on what the Great Lakes Water Authority does. So once they've finished with their work, then we will take that over and, you know, do our testing and for our customers. But long term, this is our infrastructure needs a lot of work. Detroit is in our system is the oldest part of this infrastructure, and they need the most repairs. On the drinking water side, we have fairly new into the suburbs. We have fairly new infrastructure, so it's not as aging an infrastructure issue as in the sewer and stormwater side.
I recently talked with Ronald Brenke, who's the executive director of the Michigan section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, and we were talking about the Fraser sinkhole. But he made the point that as a state, we're going to see more water main breaks and more sinkholes unless we come up with the revenue to update our aging water and sewer infrastructure. Kind of that out of sight, out of mind approach isn't going to work any longer.
Absolutely. Everybody knows where the potholes are, but nobody knows where the breaks are until they happen for the average person. So that's why operations and maintenance, when we're doing asset management, that's vitally important. We have to make sure all our assets are maintained the best they can be. Like I said, the sewer side and the stormwater side are the older infrastructure. So those are the ones that have the most issues. That's why the Fraser sinkhole was a sewer line. And we can do much more in-pipe asset management than we can in a water line because water's under pressure and there's a lot more technical issues around that. But on the sewer side, that's where a lot of our work is going to have to be done in the next 15, 20 years. And we are responsible for the welfare of the Great Lakes being the Great Lakes State. And it's a moral responsibility that we have to make sure that what we do isn't going to have a long-term impact on the lakes.
Are you getting the revenue you need from Lansing, the support you need from Lansing in order to do what you want to do to maintain the water and sewer infrastructure in Oakland County, or is there more that you could use?
I would like to do more. Again, tends to be in the older communities, it tends to be the least economically advanced communities, like in Pontiac here in Oakland County. It's one of the older in terms of infrastructure, but it's also one of the poorer communities, so they have much less of an economic base to pay for all these things. If especially the economically disadvantaged communities really need a hand with this stuff, and the state can really step in there. Mostly, though, in Michigan, it's a local responsibility. The local ratepayers are the ones that pay all the costs of doing it. It used to be more funded by the state and federal governments, but that's dropped off in the past 10, 15 years, and it's really only entirely up to the local folks. We could use a lot of help from the state. It would be the long-term good of our infrastructure has to be maintained, and we need help from the state for that.
Jim Nash, Oakland County Water Resources Commissioner. Thanks so much for your time, Jim.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
The gales of November came early to the Upper Peninsula and Lake Superior. And just to make things extra interesting, snow hit the ground up there today with more on the way. MLive Chief Meteorologist Mark Torregrossa is here now via Skype. Mark, we're hearing word of dangerous and historic wind and waves. What is the latest from the UP?
Well, you know, historic, we kind of have to put an asterisk there because we've only been measuring them, the waves on Lake Superior and the Great Lakes, with accurate buoys and a halfway decent density of buoys for maybe 10 to 30 years, depending on where you're at in Lake Superior. So what we saw was a 28.8 foot wave, almost a 30 foot wave reported at the Granite Island buoy, which is north of Marquette. And that's the highest wave that's ever been recorded with modern records on Lake Superior.
We're talking 2-3-story wave. What about winds? How high are they getting?
The strongest wind gust we saw was at Standard Rock, and that was 77 miles an hour. There were quite a few 75, 74 reports. Isle Royale, 63. So there was some 77s, and I even saw one buoy report a 93 knot wind gust, which is 107 miles an hour. We think that was an error because it's the only report like that. But again, you're looking at a instrument spacing of, 50 or 100 miles away. So we don't know. It was in the middle of what looked like the heaviest rain and even possibly a thunderstorm out there on Lake Superior. So maybe it was true.
Mark, this storm has already claimed two lives. You got two people swept off black rocks at Presque Isle Park yesterday, and the Coast Guard had to call off the search because the wind and waves are too dangerous. So this is fierce and dangerous, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I was wondering myself, how a helicopter is going to fly and do a rescue when winds are gusting to 75 miles an hour. That just didn't sound like it was going to work to me. And why people would be even close to this fury on the Great Lakes, I have no idea.
And I'm seeing this word bombogenesis as the culprit here. What on earth is bombogenesis?
I don't know about the bombogenesis, but we call it bomb cyclogenesis. And what that is when a storm center rapens at a very deep rate. And we have some stipulations or some benchmarks of how much the air pressure has fallen in, say, a six-hour time period. And what it equates to is a storm gets very deep very quickly, and then that brings the wind, because that's what causes wind. These storms are kind of like a bowl or a valley, so to speak, and when that valley deepens, then in comes the wind to rush in to kind of fill that.
I'm curious, Mark, is this what happened in the storm that took down the Edmund Fitzgerald that night of November 10th, 1975?
Oh, most certainly. Same kind of deal. I mean, these are fairly typical storms of late October and early November. So, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Of course, back in 1975, we had two computer models that were very crude, and they gave us a 12, 24, 36-hour, and 48-hour forecast. And who knows what happens in between except for extrapolation. So back then, we didn't really have the capability to forecast these bomb cyclogenesis-type storms.
Also, just adding to the fun, MDOT Upper Peninsula just tweeted out a photo showing, hello, the first snow of the season in the central UP. What is in store for the UP and the rest of the state regarding snow over the next few days? What do you see?
It's getting colder, so they're going to start to get into the lake effect. The ground is warm, so it's probably going to have a hard time really piling up. But I could see through the weekend areas that get a couple of inches of snow here and there. Of course, as soon as it stops, it starts to melt from the ground up and it disappears. But yeah, we're into it. The weather pattern changed dramatically. I've been trying to warn people about that on MLive. And now, to me, November looks more wintry than it does fallish.
Mark Torregrossa, MLive Chief Meteorologist. As always, thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
In a musty old hall in Detroit, they prayed in the Maritime Sailors' Cathedral. The church bell chimed till it rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And the legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gives up the dead when the gales of November come early.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Why does Michigan have some of the highest auto insurance premiums in the nation? Crain's Detroit Business and Bridge Magazine dug into the heart of that question that affects every single driver in our state by analyzing insurance data over a 14-year span. And it found repairing people now costs a whole lot more than repairing cars. Most of your auto insurance premium goes to PIP, Personal Injury Protection. Chad Livengood of Crain's Detroit Business is here now via Skype to tell us more. Chad, what's the time span you studied and what was the data?
We looked at data that the insurance industry hands over every year to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners from 2000 to 2013. That's the most recent year. This data lags behind by 3 years because claims for broken cars and broken bones kind of lag behind, and the payouts are not always precise year to year. So this data we looked at in just how much of auto insurance is cost, premium is wrapped up in PIP versus collision or comprehensive or bodily injury. Those are the four main large areas of every driver's auto insurance bill. And what we found was that in 2000, PIP was 22% of all the premiums collected in Michigan on auto insurance, and collision was 46% of all premiums. 14 years later, the entire equation has flipped. PIP is now 52% of the premiums, and collision is 27%. There are fewer accidents, there are fewer injured drivers, but the actual premiums collected and the payouts for and losses on treating those drivers per driver cost has tripled in a 14-year period, from less than $25,000 to more than $75,600. All along, as this has continued, these medical costs continue to pile up, the auto insurers simply take those losses every year, and then they recalculate their rates, and then they raise rates again. And the number of incurred claims, that this the number of injured drivers between the in this 14-year period actually declined by 10,000, from 53,000 and change to 42,000 and change. So the cost of these per driver accidents has really escalated severely. And the amount of premium being collected to pay for these bills has increased 278% over that 14-year period.
That's kind of eye-popping. And I guess intuitively you might think, gee, fewer people being hurt in car accidents would mean the personal injury protection chunk should also go down, but instead skyrocketing. I mean, why is this happening?
Well, the biggest driver is that Michigan has an unlimited medical benefit for injured drivers under the no-fault auto insurance law. And it's unlimited in two fashions. One, the total amount that you can have paid out by your insurer for your lifetime medical costs, and that ranges from the broken bone to someone who is paralyzed and bedridden and needs 24-hour care, basically, within their own home or a nursing home. Those are the most catastrophic injuries. But then with the person who's going through the hospital for a whiplash or a back injury and then goes to a post-hospitalization type clinic, outpatient clinic, those providers, there's no limit on what they can charge. It is simply what the insurance company will pay, because there is no cost containments built into the medical portion of auto insurance. There's no provider networks like we have with where Blue Cross will come and negotiate a set rate to get injuries for with different hospitals. Sometimes Blue Cross pays U of M a different rate than they pay St. Joe across town. So they don't have this in no-fault auto insurance. All the cost efficiencies that we have in our modern healthcare system don't exist in this system. So it turns into either the insurance company pays the claim, or the insurance company sits on the bill, and then the provider or the driver, through an attorney, go and sue in what is known first-party lawsuits. They sue the insurer, and they end up in court. And then all this litigation costs gets put into the cost of medical and treating injured drivers. And what we reported previously in Cranes is that statewide, over the last decade, there has been a 130% increase in the number of these first-party lawsuits in no-fault insurance, a system that was really designed in the early 70s to get rid of tort and litigation between drivers over who's going to pay the medical bills. Now, these hospitals and medical providers are constantly almost in litigation and war with the insurance industry.
You know, people, Chad, who are sick and tired of paying high premiums, and that's really, you're going to hear that complaint across the state, they want a villain. They want someone to blame. Is there a villain in Michigan? Is there someone to blame?
Well, you have this system where it is essentially a blank check. It's a blank check on both ends here. There's no cost containment in medical. There's no way to contain those costs. At the same time, the insurance companies work under a system called file and use, which is basically what it sounds like. They file their insurance rates with the state insurance commissioner, and then they use them. And there's little oversight by the insurance commissioner's office, because they don't have the type of power to reject rates, to see whether the insurance companies are immensely profiting from this, from the rates that they file. And so rates just continue to kind of creep up. And so, I mean, I'm not going to pick a villain in all this. It is a system that continues to sort of escalate, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight here.
Chad Livengood's piece is in Cranes Detroit Business, the healthcare crack up. Chad Livengood, always great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
There There is so much to know about this great, big, diverse state of ours. We can't possibly know about it all. So that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you have a question about Michigan, something or someone you've always wondered about, send it along. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
The word magic may conjure images of witches and wizards casting spells in some bygone era, long before the rise of science and modern civilization. But there is a spot in our state where Michigan magic still thrives. This is Wednesday, and it's time to talk history with our partner at the Michigan History Center. We are joined by Steve Ostrander, a historian with the Michigan History Center, and also Jeff Taylor, board member of the American Museum of Magic in Marshall.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Let's set the stage now. Steve, when would you say modern magic first appeared in Michigan?
The truth is, there's been magicians in Michigan almost as long as Michigan has been a state. But the real renaissance of magic in Michigan, I would say, began when Harry Blackstone, we're talking about Harry Blackstone Sr. here because his son, Harry Blackstone Jr., was also a magician. Blackstone made the small town of Colon, Michigan in St. Joseph County, which is down by Three Rivers. He made it his summer residence, and, you know, he's from Chicago. He was based out of Chicago, and the city in the summertime is hot, and people didn't like to go to shows in the summer and sit in a hot theater. So they would take the whole summer off and go someplace to relax and unwind from the road and do maintenance on their stage props. And so he chose the small town of Colon for that. So he moved his family, and all of the people associated with his show would go there in the summer to recharge.
Jeff Taylor, I know Harry Blackstone Sr. is regarded as one of our greatest magicians, but tell us about him. Tell us about his background and how he came to become a magician.
You know, like most magicians, he saw a magician when he was a kid. It was said that he saw a performance by a magician named Keller, who, along with Blackstone, is what we consider one of the four greats of stage magic. And really just sort of, you know, began doing small tricks to entertain his friends, but then slowly started working up in terms of the size of his audience. He was working as a cabinet maker at a young age, and all of those woodworking skills, of course, would eventually help him create the props that he would use on stage in later years. He began to grow his illusions, began to grow his show. He eventually purchased other stage apparatus from other magicians, found a magician by the name of Frederick the Great, who had canceled a tour but had a lot of great posters. Magicians at that time advertised by hanging posters in the towns that they were performing. He performed as Frederick the Great up until about the First World War, when a name like Frederick the Great was a little too German for his audience. His name was actually Bhutan, and then there's a number of different stories about how he chose the name Blackstone. There is, of course, a famous Blackstone Hotel in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There were rumors of Blackstone Cigar or something along those lines, but he did choose the name Blackstone and really became one of the great stage performers, you know, mostly because of his fantastic ability. He put on a fantastic stage show.
Did I understand he was able to take what was a short vaudeville act, and it became like a full-length program with 43 feats listed on the program?
You know, we think of magicians nowadays as sort of, you know, showing up with a suitcase. He traveled with his own railway car filled with equipment that he moved into a stage. He traveled with dozens and dozens of assistants. It was a big show. It's hard to appreciate nowadays, but he actually had an advanced team that went into a town. They booked the theaters. They found the hotel rooms for his stagehands. They went out and found all the rabbits that he was going to use on stage. He always gave away his rabbits to kids in the audience. So this really was a big operation. You know, as Steve said, it employed, you know, dozens of people, and they stayed together and worked together for years.
And his heyday, you would say, was this the Roaring Twenties?
Well, probably his real heyday starts in the 1930s, where he becomes sort of that number one name in performance magic all throughout the Second World War and into the 1950s. Hmm. He quit performing on stage in the mid-1950s.
You know, when we think of big names today, David Copperfield comes to mind. I remember seeing his show at the Fox Theater in Detroit, and it was jam-packed. So he was a big deal. Would we say the David Copperfield of his day?
It's a little hard to say, just because magic is just a little different now. I mean, in the last 30 or so years, we certainly associate the big stage names with Las Vegas. And, of course, Copperfield has toured, and Lance Burton toured, and Penn & Teller, but Las Vegas is really the epicenter. Blackstone was a little different in that, you know, he traveled to all of his sites. And, you know, certainly in terms of money, Copperfield far exceeded what Blackstone was able to accomplish. But, yeah, I mean, they're certainly on the same plane.
So here's this famous magician, and Steve Ostrander, he sets down his roots for a summer home in Colon. How did that play with the locals?
Well, you know, I think that they actually welcomed him, and they welcomed all the industry that he brought there. He not only had his entourage that they would repair all their props in the summertime, and, you know, all these people lived there, and they stimulated the economy there, but also Blackstone was a partner in a company. First, it was called the Blackstone Magic Company, and they manufactured kids' toys, props of magic kits and things like that. And he was in partnership with a man named Percy Abbott, who was an Australian magician who came up here, came to visit Blackstone, came to Colon, liked it, and actually settled there too. But they started this company, unfortunately a short-lived company. They had a falling out, Blackstone and Abbott did. Blackstone got out of the company. A few years later, Abbott started up the company again as Abbott's Magic Company. Then the company was based in Colon for many years. And then the other thing they had was Abbott started what they called a get-together in Colon every year. All these magicians really from all over the world would come to Colon, and they would have like a magic convention, and they would all get together and network and talk to each other and just have a good time. And this goes on still in August in Colon.
In fact, did he name his home Blackstone Island? It was like, hey, everybody, come on and check out the magic. He was very open to the locals.
He did. I read a story, and Jeff can corroborate this, where his first wife said that she was driving around in the area, came around the corner, saw this beautiful island on this lake, and she just knew immediately. She said, this is the place. This is where we should come and settle. And she said she could visualize the word Blackstone in white rocks on the bank of the lake. And so it was sort of one of those things that was meant to be.
Jeff Taylor, did that presence of Harry Blackstone Sr., did that kind of build the foundation for a magic industry in that chunk of West Michigan?
Yeah, it's really amazing because, you know, to have this going on in such an out-of-the-way place, I mean, if you've been to Colon, you know it is still very much a small town. It's quite a distance from the nearest expressway exit. And you can only imagine what it must have been when Blackstone first moved there, even smaller, even more remote. The great thing is, as Steve mentioned, you know, magicians would come for this get-together. And they would come literally from all over the world. You know, the list of names that have either been there, performed there, or purchased magic apparatus from the Abbott Company, you know, is really a who's who of magicians in the last 70 years or so. It's unique to see something like this in a small town. If we'd have said this was New York City or Los Angeles, we'd say, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. But the fact that it is, you know, was and still is in Colon, Michigan is pretty extraordinary.
The American Museum of Magic is in Marshall. Why was it located in Marshall, Jeff?
Basically, because it was the whim of the founder of the museum, Bob Lund. Bob was a longtime collector of magic, was a good friend of Harry Blackstone Jr., had met Blackstone Sr. as well. He simply liked the town of Marshall. Marshall's a little bigger town than Colon.
Fair enough. And what do we see if we come into the museum these days?
Well, you're going to see several hundred years worth of magic history. The museum has a fantastic collection of posters. We do have apparatus as well. You're going to see some really amazing pieces of magic history there. And it really is sort of a visual delight with all those fantastic posters. And there's a lot of information there, not just on Blackstone Jr. and Sr., but some other Michigan magicians as well.
It's fun, isn't it, Steve, to think, all right, we've got this kind of maybe unknown to a lot of people, this image of Michigan is kind of a capital of magic.
It is fun. You know, everybody loves magic. And You know, we've talked about Harry Sr. a lot here. Harry Jr. was born down there in Three Rivers, and Harry Jr., I mean, I'm old enough to remember Harry Jr., seeing him on TV and in movies, and he was actually on a lot of television shows. He did cameo roles in a lot of television shows, and that was the big difference between him and his father, as Harry Sr. went out on tour and played the places where Harry Jr. did that also, but he was also involved in film and television.
The primary difference between the two is sort of the age of television. You know, Harry Sr. got out of the business as television was becoming, you know, more and more available in the homes of Americans. Blackstone Jr. was able to embrace television. Actually worked on the Smothers Brothers shows and a few other shows, but as Steve said, it was really a very accomplished and highly respected magician in his own right.
That's Jeff Taylor, board member of the American Museum of Magic in Marshall, along with Steve Ostrander from the Michigan History Center. Thanks so much to both of you for bewitching us with this magical Michigan tale.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Up next, Michigan author Doug Stanton talks about his new book on the Vietnam War, The Odyssey of Echo Company. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The last U.S. troops left Vietnam on March 29, 1973. America's direct intervention in the Vietnam War was at an end after eight bloody years and 58,220 American lives lost. The nation and those veterans had a tough time processing and talking about this war that did not end with victory. But those vets are moving into their 70s, and time's growing shorter for them to tell their stories. Traverse City author Doug Stanton brings us a story of an Army recon platoon fighting its way through the Tet Offensive of 1968. His latest book, Odyssey of Echo Company, brings us the Vietnam War through the eyes of a young paratrooper named Stan Parker, and what a story it is. Doug Stanton, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Well, you have explored the sinking of the Indianapolis in World War II with your book In Harm's Way. That was the 900 sailors facing sharks in the elements and floating for 4 days. Only 317 survived. Your book Horse Soldiers, about that small, tough band of American soldiers who fought the Taliban in Afghanistan on horseback. What turned your attention to the Vietnam War and to Echo Company?
I met Stanley Parker, the son of an iron worker from Gary, Indiana, in a helicopter in Afghanistan researching horse soldiers. I was standing in at the ramp. We were trying to go to the Pakistan border. I was hoping to live with a special forces camp for a couple of days. And this older soldier had asked me if I'd written In Harm's Way, my World War II story, which I see as a survival story. I'm interested in those existential moments when we can peer into someone's soul and realize what it means to try to be human in an inhumane environment, essentially.
That's true survival.
Right. Stanley had read that book, and he said, would you write about Vietnam? It's 2005. We're flying over Afghanistan. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think America is ready to really hear the Vietnam story in the midst of these two other wars, including Iraq. So time passed as it does. I lectured in Colorado at the Air Force Academy, and we began a correspondence. And thus began the odyssey, my own odyssey, to write the book, The Odyssey of Echo Company, because I really felt it's a journey for Stan Parker from the Midwest through boyhood into Vietnam. He comes home, and the homecoming is so important. This book, in some ways, I hope, is a homecoming. And then we go back to Vietnam with Stan in 2014, and something happens, which really, I think, snaps the book into focus.
I found it interesting, as this percolated in your mind, you finally felt ready, and when you reached out to Stan, he said, everybody's ready to talk now.
Yeah, he had been thinking of this for years. This is why I think America needs to listen now, and why I think Vietnam is one of our unfinished narratives for us as a country. You and I can talk about World War II very easily, and even the Civil War, but when we come to Vietnam, what's our frame of reference? And I try to separate the soldier from the war in this. You don't have to really like Vietnam, but who does? And you don't have to dislike it either. You just simply have to be in witness of the story and listen, because I think all of us need to listen. This book is about acknowledgement and citizenship in a way. It's just an act of witness. And we have so many other veterans coming home from other wars, men and women, and they're going to need the same kind of attention. So it's a book about storytelling.
Let's talk about Echo Company and its men. Mm-hmm. Now, these were Screaming Eagles, the 101st Airborne, and their job was particularly risky, wasn't it?
It's very risky because they're the reconnaissance platoon of a battalion. So there are four other companies in the battalion. So let's say you and I are part of the platoon. We'd say, let's go downtown, see what's going on. We'll radio back to headquarters here. And if it's good or bad, we'll make a decision. But we're out there on our own, and we're highly trained but really ill-prepared for what happens in this thing called the Tet Offensive.
It's pretty heartbreaking as you read Stan's journey from this gung-ho mm-hmm. kid who signed up right after high school, and he could not wait to get in. And you see the realities of combat and what it does to him.
You know what? You're right. Yeah, and you think, well, why would he sign up? Well, traveling around the country and interviewing, here they are, the sons of World War II, and the daughters, by the way. So Stan's father had been in World War II 21 years earlier. So we're 17 years on, essentially, from 9/11, 16. And that influences our daily life so much. So we just want to remember for a moment, 1966, while there is protest in America, 67 and 68 are the boiling points. And very quickly, the world changes. It's not a war they're prepared for.
Not a war that their fathers could relate to.
Right.
The ones who fought in Korea, the ones who fought in World War II.
They are prepared for the war, but they're not prepared for its tempo and chaos. I mean, they're highly trained. They have to first enlist in the Army, which they did, and then volunteer for the recon platoon. But it's asymmetrical. We're not taking ground. How are we keeping score? It's through the body count. We're living alone. We're not sleeping. Ambush at night. Walk during the day. There is no tent. There is no sleeping bag. It is a completely animal-like experience. And you're 19 years old, and the helicopter is taking us from point A to point B in a matter of a day to six different locations. I think the book, if anything, attempts to order chaos. And this brings us today, Cynthia. When you ask a Vietnam veteran what happened, often they don't know how to begin to talk about it. And if you can't tell your story, it's not your story because you don't have the story. And so this is what I think with the Ken Burns documentary and so many things that are 50th anniversary that we can reflect on today.
Remind us again, especially for those who were not around when this was in the headlines, what happened with the Tet Offensive in 1968?
So the war had been supposedly going somewhat well. It really hadn't. I mean,
but that's what the folks at home in America were being told.
Right. It was tough. We won't crunch the numbers right here, but President Johnson and General Westmoreland, for instance, had promised that there was light at this end of this tunnel, that things were trending upward. On January 30th and 31st of 1968, you know, say months after these promises back in the States, some 100,000 enemy troops had simultaneously attacked throughout the country.
At a time when they had said they wanted a truce for their holiday.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
So how could this be? How could this be true and happen at the same time we're quote, beating them? And so the disparity, the dissonance between that statement and those images, which I wasn't old enough to really have this focused in my consciousness, and part of the book is trying to figure this out for myself, but those images on the television screen of this happening around the country were so unsettling to America that strategically the North Vietnamese had a turning point here. Tactically, they lost. The Viet Cong were crushed. The MVA were suffering enormous losses, by the way, in bombing. It was not as if they were a robust force here that was not feeling any pain. They were. But the Tet came out of nowhere, and Walter Cronkite took off his glasses on the air and said, things aren't as well as we thought. And guess what happened next? President Johnson decides not to run for re-election.
The whole public opinion at home,
right.
That was, as you say, a watershed moment.
Right, exactly.
How did Stan and the other men in his unit, how did they come to view this war that they were fighting and dying in? Kind of give us a sense of those gung-ho kids in basic training and then their journey.
Almost like any other soldier in any war, I want to point out. But in particular, there are letters in the book that are on the pages. You can read Stan saying, we're going to go get him. General Westmoreland says we're winning. And 3, 4, 5 months later, he's really fighting like all soldiers for the person next to him, and he's fighting to get home in this case. So I imagine the first boot coming out of the first helicopter, stepping down into the ground and pushing off. And at that point, that young man is innocent, and he thinks that he's stepping towards victory. Quickly, those steps become nothing more than a journey home. And that journey takes 50 years, actually. And it's taking 50 years for so many of us that we meet at the library and the movie line. Anybody who's 70 is thinking about Vietnam. And if you don't believe that, just go up and ask a question. And if you're 40 or if you're 20, you're still in a family that's thinking about Vietnam, because everyone knows somebody who was there, as Michael Hare says in his great book, Dispatches. And this is why I think it's an important story to tell.
I'm talking with Doug Stanton, the author of The Odyssey of Echo Company, looking at the 1968 Tet Offensive and the battle to survive the Vietnam War. What was Recon Platoon's casualty rate? You kind of opened the book with it. It was pretty ferocious.
Yeah, they had a high in, what did I say, 80%, 74% casualty rate. So, and Stan Parker was wounded three times. Three of the personnel were killed, which was David Fravel, Charlie Pyle, and Daryl Lintner. Those deaths, what's so heartbreaking and both poignant is the privacy of the terror and the small homages that the guys paid to each other.
What do you mean by privacy of the terror?
Well, no one remembers Charlie Pyle or Daryl Lintner.
But isn't that true in every war? When
it
you
is.
Think of all the...
That is the terror of the war. Then it's the private... What's terrible about it is how private it is and how the loss of that person will never live again. And these guys, and like I say, our neighbors come home having experienced this, and they're thinking about it. It's like Vietnam is our secret. I met a gentleman in Raleigh, North Carolina recently who had been executive of a Fortune 500 company. He said, I quickly learned not to tell anyone on the board that I had been in Vietnam. Now, he had not, you know, his tour had been harrowing, but he'd come home like every other soldier from every other war, but the community messaging was, we don't want to know. So that is a national shame. Why should that be? Why should that guy, all the energy he's spending keeping that secret is energy he's not doing something else with in his life.
It's like that open program on the computer going,
right.
Always drawing energy. Speaking of that adjustment home, I'd love if you'd read an excerpt from The Odyssey of Echo Company that really kind of very eloquently addresses that feeling of disconnect when they come home. Set it up for us.
Sure. Dwight Lane is returning to rural Indiana. He's been a member of Reconnaissance Platoon with Stanley Parker and a fellow named Charlie Pyle, who was killed in March of 1968 and whose death is a marker. You know what? We'd be sitting around and, hey, this happened after Charlie died, or this happened before Charlie died. And this is how we keep time in war. And I wanted to note Dwight's own honoring of Charlie's memory. Returning home, Dwight Lane tries to make sense of Charlie Pyle's death and discovers, as far as he can tell, that there isn't any. It happened. Charlie died. This is the best he can come up with. Dwight had joined the Army to escape Indiana and see the world. Growing up, he often wondered about the scars his father had gotten in World War II, which the old man never talked about. It will be years on his father's deathbed, in fact, before his father will tell Dwight what he thinks of that war, marching across Europe, the bodies that will spring up in his field of vision years later, back in Indiana, when he's idling along in his life, being Dwight's father. But if Dwight had been able, as he knelt in the rice paddy with Charlie Pyle in his arms, Dwight would have chosen, with all of his might, at that moment, to slide forward in time and come to rest at his father's deathbed. And he would have been close to his father's lips and listened as the old man explained how to understand the death of Charlie Pyle. What would his father have told him, he wonders? Accept it? Move on? Accept death? He doesn't know what his father would have said, and he knows that he never will. The truth is, the platoon loved Charlie Pyle in those moments when he was alive with them, and then he was gone. After the war, few look for his family, for his friends. They never look for sign of him after the war. They remember him, though. They remember him. They never forget.
Doug Stanton reading an excerpt from The Odyssey of Echo Company. As you talk about this book, you've got an event tonight at the Ann Arbor District Library. You're meeting people. What surprises you? What jumps out at you as far as the reactions people have to talking about this war?
I'm surprised, though I shouldn't be, it's true of my other books, that women are buying this book, because what it is they're eavesdropping by proxy on what grandfather did, father, uncle, brother. And And, you know, the American male opens up around 70. He loosens up. You know, Tom Brokaw discovered this. But women are much more advanced than men, and they do this earlier in life, and they're willing. They're actually, their steel is harder, and so they're able to confront this story, and they want to know. And that's what surprised me, is just that.
Yeah, because certainly Brokaw was able to get those memories in The Greatest Generation from the World War II soldiers, Stephen Ambrose with, for example, Citizen Soldiers and Band of Brothers. There's something about reaching that 70-something mark where you kind of realize time is running out and you don't have forever to let this get out. What did telling his story do to you for Stan Parker?
It made me realize that we don't have to solve the world's problems, but we do have to, I think, engage and listen to them. I mean, we can't solve them. We do have to solve them, but how can we? And there is so much going on in the world right now, and I've written 3 books about combat. But what I realized that these veterans in particular, let's not even use the word veteran, these people, this is a book about people, wanted to be acknowledged. And they didn't want me to either accept or reject them. They prefer that I not reject them. But the fact that I was listening, what you asked surprised me, I can't tell you the depth of feeling that a generation of Americans has that no one has ever listened to them, whatever race or creed. And it's shocking. And it is like this other substrate of story floating through our consciousness among all the other chaos that's going on that I think is worthy of exploration. Stan Parker, 18 years after he comes home from Vietnam, is getting gas in Colorado, and a gentleman walks up and says, "Were you in Vietnam?" Because he sees his cap. Stan says, "Yes." He's shocked by the question. "May I buy your gas?" That was the first time anyone in Stan Parker's life had said the word Vietnam to him, other than a World War II veteran when he, shortly after he came home, met him at the mailbox, retrieving his own mail. Stan said, "Hey, how you doing?" The guy said, "Well, I haven't seen you in a while, Stan Parker." And he said, "Well, I've been over in Vietnam." And the guy said, "Well, that's okay. We don't need to talk about that." And he went back into his house. So however you felt about the war, it does not matter. What matters is the humanity of our fellow citizens and the pain that we're all carrying, and in this case, because of the Vietnam War. And so what surprised me is just my lack of awareness of that.
And when you think of the legacy of this war, Doug, how does what happened there 50 years ago still impact our military, our foreign policy, and our psyche as Americans?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the fact that we left Vietnam not as the as our usual victor cautioned us against future wars. We're always fighting the last war, they say. I will say that my book, Horse Soldiers, is about another American experiment in counterinsurgency that was successful. So maybe we learned from those lessons. But I want to say that I think, first of all, it's the way we treat people returning from combat today. The great lesson from Vietnam is to separate the war from the soldier. If you look at Colin Powell's 2003 speech to the UN about weapons of mass destruction, most people I know in intelligence, you know, say they weren't there in the way we thought. Just compare that to the Gulf and Tonkin resolution in 64, another political reason to go into war, both of them spurious. Well, we treat the two veterans of those two different contexts very differently. But why? I mean, that's the question, we won't answer it here, but we should reflect on that.
Doug Stanton is appearing this evening at the Ann Arbor District Library talking about the Odyssey of Echo Company. He's going to take questions, sign his book. The event is co-hosted by Nicola's Book, so it's 7 to 8:30 tonight, Ann Arbor District Library. The Odyssey of Echo Company. Doug Stanton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Danny Hensel, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.